I was born in a small town, and I live in a small town. Probably die in a small town, or the small communities.
Nowadays, most bright and talented young people aren't planning on dying in that same small town. Instead, they tend to leave for college and never come back. And when you look at the job prospects in many of those towns, you can't blame them. But it doesn't have to be that way. I'm Sarah McConnell, and today on With Good Reason, some new thoughts on encouraging homegrown businesses to boost their small town economies.
Oh, I cannot forget from where it is that I come from. Cannot forget the people who really love me. Well, I can be myself here in this small town. And people let me be just what I want to be. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Later on today's show, a small community in Ecuador refuses to let the giant oil companies set the agenda.
They are concerned of what happened to their sister communities in the northern part. The only thing that they have encountered is a devastation to their territory. They don't have better roads or better hospitals or better schools.
But first, often when small towns try to pep up their economy, they go looking for some huge factory or business that will employ lots of local people. Insiders call this landing the whale, but it may be better to instead foster several smaller homegrown businesses. Dolphins, not whales. Greg Fairchild is a professor of business administration at the University of Virginia's Darden Graduate School of Business. He's also director of the Taylor Murphy Institute, which is recognizing and rewarding homegrown businesses that are providing jobs in small towns.
In 1962, the University of Virginia received an anonymous gift from a donor. This came just after the death of Taylor Murphy. Taylor Murphy had been the treasurer of the Commonwealth under Colgate Darden. The charge of the center is to go out and find the pocketed parts of our Commonwealth where people right now are having elevated unemployment, where plants are closing, where we are experiencing the effects of a post-industrial economy, where one day and at one time people grew tobacco. I could be talking about a number of places. I could be talking about Franklin right now, where the International Paper Plant is closing. I could be talking to you about Lynchburg, where the Craddock Terry Shoe Plant existed. And generations of people found that this corporate player was not only a source of employment, but invested in the community in so many ways. The educational system, scholarships for people interested in going away to college, investments in parks, so on and so forth. Those companies have, in many cases, either declined in their employment base or in some cases have altogether closed. And those generations of people who have become accustomed to having that type of support are finding that they have to think in new ways about reframing, readjusting, and growing.
The people who live and work in these communities, what are they going through right now? Have you toured any of these areas with some business people and sort of had some personal impressions about what you saw or felt?
Yeah. So down in Danville, I had a conversation with a father and son, and they had a business that employs a number of people in the community in the janitorial field. And my conversation with them was about the sense that there was possibility, economic possibility. They found that when they arrived, the degree of, let's call it, post-traumatic stress in the community was real, that people didn't have a sense that they had the ability to take control of their economic fortune. And they found that they were a spark to many of the people that they met. In September, I went down to Danville, and I was talking with the person behind the desk, and I said, you know what, I want to go to dinner tonight, and I want to find a place where I can get some local food. And the lady behind the desk said, okay, well, you can go to the Outback Steakhouse. And she named two other chain restaurants. And I said, you know, those sound like great places to have dinner, but is there a food that is associated with this town that I could find? Is there just a traditional place? And they both said, really, that there wasn't. I think that the comfort you get in knowing that your blooming onion in your Outback in any city in America is going to be there loses the sense that there's something special about having food that is traditional to that area.
So you lose some community pride?
You lose community pride, you lose community connection, and you even lose the role model sense. Communities take pride in having the notion that there's someone that grew up here, raised here, we know them, and they've created a business that has grown, employs people, and it's one that we can all enjoy.
Is there an economic difference in the community between chains and locally owned businesses otherwise?
No, we don't know of any economic difference, but there's certainly a psychological difference. And it's when the chain leaves, you often find that you have the shell still standing there. And it's the visible shell in many cases that lead to and contribute to a sense that people have of economic despair.
You gave a speech in Danville where you referred to a kind of vision for a business future that you call the whales and the dolphins. What do you mean by that?
Landing the whale is this getting another large business into the community. We can find another large corporate player to come in. Communities have played the same game with sports teams. We can bring in a stadium, and a stadium would produce this number of jobs. On the other hand, what I've proposed is that communities would expand their notion of how we grow an economy to the breeding and raising of the dolphins. Dolphins, relative to whales, they're smaller. They move in pods. They communicate with each other. They can rise and fall with the current in ways that a very large animal is much less able to do. And so if we think about an economy where unexpected things might happen, then in certain ways, dolphins provide another way of dealing with a potentially changing sea.
So by these big whales in the community, you mean the factories and the businesses that employ a couple thousand?
I mean businesses that employ a couple of thousand, yes.
And by contrast, the dolphins would be like what?
100 or fewer people. The majority of people in America are employed by businesses that are relatively small. 500 people or fewer, they're the majority of workplaces in which people spend their time. In all of these places, a recognition that that was a wonderful way to have done business for a time, but that there's some risk associated with that. And you're seeing the evidence of the risk in a lot of places. You certainly see it in the economic base, but you see it in the young people. When I was in Danville, I had a fascinating conversation. I spent time with gifted high school students, and I was talking to them about the potential of careers in business relative to careers in science. And the fascinating thing about this conversation was I said, now, raise your hand if you think that you're going to go out of the region to go to college. And of the 50 young people, literally all but four of them say they're going to leave the region. And I asked them to all stand up. And so I then say, okay, I want you to remain standing if after college you intend or think that you will return to the region. And out of the room of 50, only two of these young people thought they would return. So many communities in America right now, especially rural communities, especially communities in the South, are giving up their young people. Their biggest export is no longer the timber. It's no longer the textiles. It's the youth, the energy, the vitality, the hope.
So how do you turn that around?
It becomes a conversation less about growing up one day and maybe you end up working in the plant or maybe you end up going away to be an athlete. And it becomes a series of steps that explain how you actually think about starting businesses that are locally driven.
So how would you help do that? What's your vision for helping communities retain their brightest and their best?
First, in all of these communities, there already are businesses. They're the people who put their name on the back of the Little League uniform. They're the people who buy large numbers of Girl Scout cookies, and they're the people who employ 30, 40, 50 people. They're running a business which is even the local George Bailey-style bank. And it's those businesses that we want to really step and connect with through our work. One of the ways we plan to do that is to provide connection and recognition. When so much of the story about a hard-hit community is this big plant is leaving, we want to create a separate narrative, which is about, and there are these businesses that are there, they're strong, and these people are committing to their communities. This April, we're beginning one of our new initiatives, and it's our way of bringing attention to this matter and connecting to the real people that are out there. We have created something we call the Taylor Murphy Resilience Award. Between April and July 1, we're going to be accepting applications and nominations. So if there are people that view themselves as a resilient business, or if there are people in the community that know of a resilient business, there's an online nomination form which allows us to hear about the growth of these businesses economically, the numbers of people they employ, but the vision of the owners on how they contribute to the base of strength and resilience in their community.
And typically in a hard-hit community?
Absolutely in a hard-hit community. These are the businesses we are most interested in hearing from. We recognize that it's hard to compare businesses across industries. So in addition to the Chairman's Award, we'll have an arrayed set of winners from manufacturing, from retailing, from service.
And what do they win?
We believe that the best thing we do is we provide world-class education at the Darden School. And we want these folks that have been running these businesses to come into our classroom, not so much to hear from us, but also to tell their story to other world-class executives.
What will that gain them? What will that gain others?
Awareness is one. Understanding and appreciation is another. The notion of being connected to the Darden School also opens up another series of relationships with angel investors, people from other parts of the world, other parts of the country who have dollars and would like to invest them in viable businesses.
This may be naive, but what sorts of things could a Fortune 500 company representative share with a small town business owner that he or she doesn't already know?
So I think that the learning is going to happen on both sides. One of the big questions that large corporations deal with is labor and understanding how, once you've decided to buy land in a rural community in America, it could be that the person running the business that's already there knows the labor market, knows the consumer market even better than the executive that's coming in. There's local knowledge, which involves the community itself, but it also is an insight about how one builds strong connections with and finds quality talent in places like this. My students that are in the classroom right now interview with a who's who of business leadership. And one of the things I think we have as a possibility through this is connecting those same young people with all of those elements we just mentioned to the notion that their opportunity might be in one of these communities that we've just talked about.
How could somebody who goes to Darden and has the possibility of making hundreds of thousands of dollars a year upon graduation find profit and satisfaction in, let's say, Danville?
I think we first have to go to what we at Darden believe we do. The mission statement says we create leaders in the world of practical affairs. And if we're serious about that, we know that those leaders in the world of practical affairs might be in places that people don't generally associate with business school. The notion that I could have a substantial influence on the future economic history of a community will be very appealing to certain people who walk in our doors. And I think we can do our part to put that option and alternative in front of them.
Are you noticing any sort of yearning on the part of business school students for maybe something other than just the financial fulfillment?
I think we're at a time where there's a national tone. Business often ends up being on the news as the problem. This movie, It's a Wonderful Life, is an American institution, and at the center of it is a banker who's very connected to loads of businesses like the ones we've talked about. That's a banking story that I think people would like to see again, and I think it's a banking story we don't hear a lot about, and I think many of the people in our building want to be George Bailey. There's a conversation that I have with students in our hallway. There's a conversation that I have with students in the classroom about meaning, purpose, mission, commitment, impact.
What sort of businesses need to happen in these areas in order for young people to find them even the least bit attractive?
So it could differ by place. You take a town like Franklin, where the International Paper Plant has been such a strong employer and has offered wonderful salaries to such a large part of the population. Well, that plant is going to close. And so one of the things you have there is an asset which is the building, an asset which is the infrastructure, be it energy, be it railroad spurs, be it roads, be it egress to water, that have all supported that business. That's an opportunity. It might be that there's a business that taps into all of those infrastructural opportunities that isn't paper at all. So there have been ideas about biofuels as an example. There have been ideas about tissue paper as an example. It is, in fact, people who can see the opportunity where others cannot, and their collective movement that can begin to reframe things.
So what specifically might Taylor Murphy have in mind for these communities after this initial wave of the new business award?
We see a number of things that we can do. We have a strong belief that entrepreneurial finance is an important element in this package, that there are needs that smaller businesses have, and I don't just mean startup businesses, for financial support and specifically loan and equity products. There might be someone sitting in Iowa right now that knows something about what to do with warehouse space that happens to be arrayed near a river, that might know something about a new form of bioagriculture that we don't know about here. Our ability to broadcast and to reach large numbers of people might allow someone who might not think about one of these communities as an economic opportunity differently.
Greg, this is really exciting. Knock 'em dead.
We plan to.
Thanks for talking with me today on With Good Reason.
Thank you.
And all my friends, it's a small town. My parents live in the same small town. My job is a small town, provides little afternoon.
Greg Fairchild is director of the Taylor Murphy Institute at the University of Virginia's Darden Graduate School of Business. Coming up next, a tiny rainforest community says no to big oil.